suspect the reason Tony, her husband, talked her into it is because Tony will only attend a church that reads the King James Bible. And Mormons, you know, have great allegiance to the King James Bible. So that's why he likes Mormons. Jan Schiff has a long association with the Washington Symposium. She spoke at the very first Washington Symposium in 1985 and has been here quite a few times since. And I don't think there is another person who writes and thinks and talks publicly about Mormonism who knows more about what is happening in the church today and has a better sense of what Mormons are about changing and why we're changing than Jan Schiff does. Someday she'll finish her long-awaited, long-promised book on what has happened in the church in the since World War II. For those of you who attended religiously the Washington Symposium and heard some of her speeches over the years, you've heard rough chapters from that book, and you know more than almost anyone else about what Jan Schiff thinks. She began her career in Mormonism because she was married to Tony, and he was studying library science at Utah State University in Logan, and she took some classes and became fascinated with these quirky people. And she continued her study of us ever since. In her early days in studying Mormonism, when she was associated with the Mormon History Association, she was the bridge between the RLDS historians and the LDS historians, when they were quite skeptical of each other. And Jan was neutral ground. And her hotel room at the annual MHA meetings was where they both could gather on neutral ground and talk and get to know each other. And the RLDS felt comfortable drinking beer in Jan's room, and the LDS felt like she understands us and it's fine that we don't. At that time, she earned the title of Den Mother of Mormon History. She has outgrown that title. Jan Schiff is, I think, the best living historian of Mormon history today. In fact, I think she is the best historian of Mormon history ever, period, in my mind. I think that because she is one of the few people who try to make sense of the big picture, try to step back and say, and read all these little nitpicky, as she quotes one other historian, one damn thing after another historians, and starts to say, what do these facts mean, and how are we changing? And you have a conversation, you read a chapter, you get an idea in her mind, and all of a sudden you're able to understand things that are happening in Mormonism much better. She's done that in the 19th century, and she's doing it now in the 20th century. In fact, years ago she committed to write this book that she hasn't finished yet on contemporary Mormonism, and she discovered before she could write that, she had to understand what happened in the 19th century Mormonism. So she wrote this book. Mormonism, the story of a new religious tradition. She really makes sense of how we changed from the pioneer culture to 20th century culture. It's a fascinating study, and it's probably on the top five must-read non-scriptural books to make sense of Mormonism. It's a classic. It's been in print all the time, and it's read in college classes around the country by tons of non-Mormon students. If you haven't read this book, you really are not up to date on Mormon scholarship. She just came out with a book because she doesn't publish many of her articles, and the ones that she does publish, she doesn't publish for Mormon audiences very much. And so she came out with a book that began just as a collection of her either unpublished talks that she's given over the years or the talks that she's published in obscure places that we wouldn't know about. But it grew into a bigger book. And she saw how the collection of these essays over time actually dealt with her 40-year sojourn in Mormonism and dealt with how Mormonism changed during that critical time that we like to call disparagingly correlation. And so, if you want a lot of clues about how to make sense of what in the world is happening in Mormonism today, buy Sojourner in the Promised Land, 40 Years Among the Mormons, by Jan Schiff. It's an excellent book. Both of these happen to be on sale in the lobby. And if we sell out, we have a lot more. And so sign your name up, and we'll take your credit card or check or cash, and we'll mail it to you when we get back into the office on Monday or Tuesday. So these two are essential readings, and they're important. Carol has a note. Every each packet has an order form. Oh, great. We're organized here. Because Jan is probably the best insightful commentator on contemporary Mormonism today, she's been signed up to be a columnist on BeliefNet.com, which is a religious news, a religious site. And if you go to that and go to Christianity and then go to Mormonism, and Jan is one of the reasons why they kept us in the Christianity section, you'll be able to read her column. And I think she'll talk about those columns a lot tonight. You know, they're fascinating reads, and they're a reason to own a computer and to get on the internet. They're a very good reason. So we're very fortunate to have Jan tonight. Take copious notes, and if you forgot a pen or pencil, you can buy the tape also in the lobby. So now we'll hear from Jan Shipps.
About to reach in my billfold and pay Elmer for all those nice things he had to say. It's sort of embarrassing sometimes to have somebody who's a very close friend, and over the years, Elbert and many of his friends and my husband and I have become very close friends, and so we do. I do feel a little bit like it's having my brother telling you about me, and I feel a little embarrassed. I am delighted to be here. I have been a part of the Washington Sunstone and the Seattle Sunstone and the Salt Lake Sunstone for many, many, many years. Have been a part of this Sunstone thing from the very beginning. I was still in my Mormon history days, as Elbert said, when I heard first that a magazine was going to be published. And although I do know Scott Kinney quite well, I didn't see the early issues and had to go and find them and pay a lot for them. But in fact, the first time I saw it was when I saw Peggy Fletcher, then Fletcher, walking up the stairs in the church archives, having that red magazine that had Mark Leone's article about the temple in it as she walked up the stairs. And I thought, boy, this is really something, that there are Latter-day Saints who can, in fact, address questions in a way that will, in fact, help people from the outside understand Mormonism and say something new, as Sunstone has been doing all these years to people inside. So that's my first, so I've been a Sunstone follower all these years. Not very long after that. Oh, I should say, just a little aside, I should start. I am going to read a little bit after a while, but I'm talking a minute first. My husband says that I speak in parentheses, and so a little parentheses. When you saw Elbert running up here, I have a nephew who happens to be in Washington today. He's a Catholic priest who is ordinarily in Nairobi, but he is in Washington, and so he's going to Elbert's trying to find him to bring him along. So if you see the Elbert brings somebody else in, it's a Shipps. So there we go. My first correspondence with Sunstone went this way, just to give you a sense of how how far back we go. Sunstone in its early years was really just trying to get started, and they were trying to get some people who had maybe written some articles elsewhere, who might have some, have some standing because they had a PhD after their name and all that kind of thing to do some writing. And so Sam Taylor, how many of you know who Sam Taylor was? Sam Taylor, John Taylor's grandson, who wrote a book called Family Kingdom. And then he was a professional writer, but he wrote a book called Family Kingdom, and then he wrote a book called Rocky Mountain Empire. It just came out, and Peggy said to me, "Would you review this book for Sunstone?" And I don't know how many of you know that when you are reviewing books, and you are an assistant professor or something like that, and you reviewed books for the Journal of American History or the Western Historical Quarterly or something, and they always said you have 300 words, or if you really pushed hard, you have 350. And so I said to Peggy, I said, "Okay, I will take this and review it. How many words can I have?" And she said, "Oh, all you want." Couldn't believe it. And so I took the book and I read it, and it was a curious kind of book, because I was at that time doing research in the church archives and reading things by Leonard Arrington and Jim Allen and Tom Alexander and all those famous names in Mormonism. And then here was this book that was written by a person who is a Mormon, but it was a totally different story. It was one of the ways that I began to see that Mormonism is very diverse, and that even for people who belong to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, you don't even have to go out to find the people who belong to the reorganized church or to find some of those Mormon fundamentalists to find diversity. There is all kinds of diversity inside Mormonism. And it was the first time I had really realized this. And it was like two different takes on a culture. Absolutely. And it was just like they were passing each other in the night. So I sat down and I read. I started writing, and I found it really interesting. And I wrote and wrote and wrote. And I sent it off to... I let some of my colleagues at Indiana University, Purdue University in Indianapolis, that university with the long name where I taught for many years, I let them read this. And they kept saying, "Oh, they'll never publish that much. They will never publish that much." And when I got the letter back from Peggy, it said, "This is wonderful. Wouldn't you like to do a little more about?" And so my first experience was that Mormon things were of real interest to people. And and it didn't have to come out in the New Era or the Ensign or BYU Studies. And it was a liberating kind of thing for me that there were a lot of people who wanted to listen and understand, and so I've been a Sunstoner ever since. Okay, I am going to read a paper. Much of this, if you are a BeliefNet reader, some of it will sound familiar, because I took some whole paragraphs out of things I wrote for BeliefNet, but they are from a variety of columns, and then I've added a lot of stuff to it, and I've called this "No More Mormon Church, What's Going On Here?" That's what people ask me. As somebody who's been around for 40 years observing and being a part of, and that's the key, being a part of the Mormon community. And I don't mean just Sunstone. I mean, I tend to, from time to time, even go to sacrament meeting in Bloomington, Indiana. I tend to know people that probably Sunstoners fell off, that Sunstoners, if they didn't fall off the side of the earth, they ought to, because I've got lots of friends in the more conservative parts of BYU and all that stuff. So I have got a lot of that there. But anyway, I have become, boast about this so much as just to inform. Many of you probably think that I do nothing except answer the telephone because my name keeps getting in the newspapers every time there's a story about the Mormons. Now, in this new book, Sojourner in the Promised Land, I do have a whole section about that because it is a part of my life. There have been times when something has happened in Salt Lake City, and I back when the Hoffman the Mormon murders happened. I mean, my phone was just ringing off the wall from all sorts of people, and they got my name. And you know, once you get in the Rolodex and LexisNexis, you'll never get back out. And so newspaper reporters have called me over the years. But I want to tell you why, Ben, and I do a fair amount of reflecting on this in the book. But one reason why is that newspaper reporters, sometimes there are religion reporters that know a lot about religion but don't know very much about Mormonism. Or there are newspaper reporters that don't know anything about religion but get assigned to a Mormon story that doesn't seem religious on the surface. Now, this happened with the Mormon murders. They were crime reporters to Salt Lake to write up that story, and they thought that it was just a straight crime story, and they were just absolutely amazed at the connections into the faith and the faith story and so forth. And they don't speak Mormon. They hear the words and they don't understand. They can't. I coined this phrase, but I feel really comfortable with this phrase. They really can't make sense of atonement discourse. It just doesn't mean very much to them. And so newspaper reporters from all over the nation have called me again and again and again. Some of them have gone so far as to call and say, "Can you explain Mormonism to me?" And you know, I'll start here, and then I'll start, and then I'll say, "No, you got to remember this, and you got to remember this, and you got to remember this." And again and again and again, I hear this same complaint. How can perfectly sane people believe all this crazy stuff? And of course, I have this sort of standard answer is that I don't know. And then I follow it up and I say, I know a lot of people, including me, who believe that there was this person that was dead and is now alive. And they stop. You can hear them on the phone sort of, you know, scratching their heads. "Oh, you mean..." Or I know some people who think that people walked across the Red Sea and didn't get wet. And so then you begin to say, this is another faith story. And that's what I've been doing all these years. And that's what's going on with me. Okay, let me do a little reading, and then I'll just I'll stop and answer questions as you like. Oh, there he is. Terrific. Hey, Frank. You guys, this is my nephew, and he is terrific.
All right. Take it.
Oh, look, freshen up. Hold my flowers for me. They're beautiful. Terrific. Oh, okay. I just was getting ready to read. I've just been talking, so you haven't missed a thing. On March 5th, 2001, and I haven't figured out how, you know, it used to be easy to say 1999 or something like that, so I don't know exactly how to say this, but on March 5th, 01, you know, ought one, or whatever, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints placed a February 23rd letter from the Church's first presidency on its website. It says calling church members Mormons is still okay. But references to their church as the Mormon Church are now officially discouraged. The letter also puts references to the church as the Latter-day Saints Church and the LDS Church on the official blacklist, describing the use of the church's full name as a form of proclamation. The brethren added that from this point forward, the Church of Jesus Christ is the preferred contraction. This announcement was anticipated, many of you know, in a story in the New York Times, February 20th, in which religion writer Gus Niebuhr, one of the better ones in history, Gus Niebuhr reported on an interview with Elder Glenn Oaks, a member of the Church's Council of the Twelve. Niebuhr said that Oaks told him he did not mind being called a Mormon, but that he did not want it to be said that he was a member of the Mormon Church. How surprised his grandfather and grandmother and even his father and mother might have been. I was not surprised, however, by what the brethren did. But I was surprised when so many of the questions about this change in terminology that came to me about whether this is all a part of a new LDS marketing strategy was the focus. Was it marketing? Reporters also wanted to know whether this change is a reaction to charges that Mormonism is not Christian. My answer to both of these questions was perhaps, but I am convinced that there is a very real difference between marketing Mormonism as Christian and religious proclamation, and that's in a way what I want to talk about. To be sure, in laying claim to the name the Church of Jesus Christ, the First Presidency is affirming Mormonism's essential Christianness. But in doing so, they are by no means engaged in a name change that is remotely akin to that which is occurring in the reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. As you may know, it is no longer the difference between having a hyphen and a small d, or no hyphen and a capital D. The RLDS Church is now officially the Community of Christ. No longer is Latter-day Saints in its name. They've been trying to escape the Mormon label for at least 100 years. In that case, the name change signifies, I feel quite certain, a move into a confessional Protestant camp. This is to say, they are moving directly into being a form of Protestantism, more like a peace church, more like Quakers or Mennonites than Methodist or Baptist, but clearly Protestant. that seems to be what is going on. In no way is this what is happening in Mountain Mormonism. This faith community may well be moving toward being a part of the nation's common religious culture. Indeed, it would be almost impossible for the Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to be the sixth largest church in the United States, which it now is, without moving in that direction. But it is not moving toward Protestantism and or Catholicism. It is still Mormonism. And although they are moving away from the Church of Jesus, they're moving away from the Mormon Church or the Latter-day Saints Church or the LDS Church, it's real hard to move away from naming the tradition Mormonism. Did you ever try to say the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saintism? It gets pretty tough. And so Mormonism, I suspect, is going to be here for a real long time. Instead, with this move, the First Presidency is pointing to their church's most fundamental doctrinal assertion, declaring anew that the institution they lead is the restored Church of Jesus Christ, the restored Church of Christ, which it was called in the beginning. What they're doing is just that simple and just that profound. Considering what the brethren propose as alternative contraction to the Church of Jesus Christ, make that very clear. The alternative, note the initial uppercase letters, is the church. That says we are the church. We are the restored church of Christ. It is what we call in religious studies an exclusive claim. We have the truth. Enough about the rest of you guys. To those who pay close attention to the spelling of words and the way they are said, this restatement is a very powerful statement indeed. Now, I want to move from that to asking several questions. Why the turn away from Mormon Church as a very useful moniker, and why just now? And what's going on within the culture to make this an important move? Once upon a time, the term Mormon identified folks with big families and phenomenal family values, people whose abstemious habits made tithing tolerable and kept the word of wisdom a snap, and keeping the word of wisdom a snap. I think we're among friends. I got to stop and tell you a little story. Back in the days before all the money went to Salt Lake and then came back, hey guys, the Latter-day Saints, you know, I'm learning to say Latter-day Saints instead of Mormons. The Latter-day Saints they tithed, and that went to Salt Lake, and then they supported their local ward. And when I heard this as a Methodist and how we have to struggle to raise money to do things, and I heard this in the I remember exactly where I was standing with a couple of Latter-day Saint scholars at IU, and we were talking, and one of them told me that the tithing goes to Salt Lake, and then the Latter-day Saints have to support their local programs. And I was so absolutely amazed. I said, God damn. And the response just like that was, that's what the Mormons say. So, making it easy to tithe has never been as easy as some people think. But whatever. Anyway, Mormon is derived, as many of you know, from Mormonite, a disparaging nickname that the first Mormon prophet turned inside out, transforming it into a brand name his followers would embrace with pride for over 150 years. Actually, if you go back in Mormon history, as I did when I did the when I edited the McClellan Diaries, it is very clear that the prophet's embracing of the term Mormon had a very practical use, because in 1830, not only was the restored Church of Christ organized, but also the Campbellites organized the Christian Church. The Campbellites, those people that are now called the Disciples of Christ. Now, the Campbellites were all over the Midwest and the South, and then moving up into New England, and there were a lot more of them. Remember, Sid Rigdon was a Campbellite. There were a lot more of them than there were of Latter-day Saints. And they got hold of the name Christian first. And they said, "We are the Christian Church." And people were getting confused. There were these two new groups that were calling themselves Christians. And there's a wonderful, wonderful account in the McClellan Diary about how there's a sister being in the baptismal, they're just being baptized, about to be baptized in the Christian church, and somebody comes along and says, "That's a false church, that's a false Christian church." And so, in a sense, Joseph Smith, very smart. I mean, he's a really smart guy. And what he did was to take the name Mormon, and it separated the Latter-day Saints from the Christians, that is, the followers of Alexander Paul et al. And so he used it, and he taught people to glory in it. You can find it in his writings. There he is. He also was, I mean, nowadays, and people say to me, "Oh, well, it's always been the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints." Wake up, folks. It was first the Church of the Latter-day Saints. When they were trying to make a distinction between being the Church of Christ and getting confused with every other Church of Christ that was around, they changed it to the Church of Latter-day Saints, and many of the brethren, we don't know what the sisters thought, but many of the brethren were very upset and said, "No, no, no." And so they then, change came, and it is in the DNC, it's in the Doctrine and Covenants. Therefore, it is regarded as revelation that the name of the church is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And that's true. It is revelation. But it took a little while to get there. And most people don't know that. But, and back to my text. Recently, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints announced that this venerable institution is no longer willing to be identified as the Mormon Church. And it additionally prefers, it says it's acceptable, but it prefers not to have its members known as Mormons. Now, if you do what I do, which is to very religiously read the official website of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, about a year ago, journalists were told not to call members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Mormons, because it was confusing, if you can believe it. And, yeah, it was confusing, because a lot of people, you know who calls them Mormons now more than anybody else? The fundamentalists. those people down in Colorado City, those people down in Manti, those people that are practicing plural marriage, they say, this is the way it's supposed to be. There should never have been a manifesto in the first place. And they call themselves Mormons. And it drives the brethren crazy. I mean, you look at the official website and it says, common misconceptions that people who practice plural marriage should be called Mormon. Little aside, I stand back sometime and say, they say, it's not traditional, it's not our kind of Mormonism, and therefore they don't have a right to be called Mormon. And yet, Mormons claim the name Christian. But believe you me, it is not traditional Christianity. Do you guys have the right to be called Christians? Well, I say yes. In the book, there's an article that's called Is Mormonism Christian? Which, by the way, was originally published in BYU Studies. But and my answer is yes. People who follow Jesus Christ and call themselves Christians have a right to do that. No Supreme Court on the earth that says us Methodists are right or Frank and his Catholics are right and you guys are wrong. I mean, who knows? We have to wait till we all get to heaven and then we'll find out. Whatever. Anyway, it's a higher court than what we've got on the earth. What this suggested to me, and this came before the brethren made this announcement, and it made Gus Niebuhr go and talk to the brethren. My first article about this in BeliefNet was headlined, The M Word. Mormonism is becoming the M Word. Using it in everyday discourse is not yet as bad as using the N Word, an epithet now only acceptable when it is used by black people within the black community, but official efforts to change the way people refer to members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the way members refer to themselves and each other is having considerable success. Even if, as the authors of Mormon America put it, trying to get to Mormonism is like trying to make water run uphill. I love it. Various explanations have been proposed for this official nomenclature shift. I see it as yet another way from another step away from the beginnings of Mormonism and from the days when most of the saints lived in Utah and its environment. And I told you I was going to say one reason I think it's happening, and I think this is very important. It indicates a universalization of the Mormon message that is being carried throughout the world by missionaries and a culture that was once embedded in the soil of the Mormon culture region. My reasoning goes this way. The members of the church, led by the first Mormon prophet, believed that theirs was the restoration of the New Testament church. This gave them special access to that bequest made to early Christians in 1 Peter 2:9, letting them understand themselves as a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people. Unlike other Christian groups who treated this heritage symbolically, the followers of Joseph Smith put on these titles literally. As the saints in a new dispensation, they were the very embodiment of a chosen generation. Their birthrights as chosen people were secured by revelation, coming mainly to making Joseph Smith senior, the patriarch to the church in Kirtland. But this made them a chosen people and gave them the Aaronic priesthood, and that is the royal priesthood. By dint of extraordinary effort, they kept trying to build up Zion until finally, under the leadership of Brigham Young, they established themselves a holy nation. then with a set of unique practices, particularly plural marriage and the word of wisdom, they made their existence as a peculiar people operational. In other words, they took this biblical statement in 1 Peter 2:9, saying that the Christians were a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, and made it come true. Their atypical patterns of behavior and singular religious practices worked as peculiarities intended to work to set the saints apart. Unfortunately, they were too sanguine about what the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution guarantees as far as religion is concerned. It provides a warrant for religious freedom, but it also ensures freedom from religion, making ours a nation that both values faith and is deeply suspicious of it. As a result, Americans are tolerant of people who are a little bit peculiar, but not tolerant of a genuinely peculiar people. As it turned out, the saints' kingdom making and their odd marital arrangements made for too much peculiarity. Consequently, the U.S. citizens living in the Great Basin became so alien in the land of their tradition of birth that they were forced to relinquish plural marriage and to dismantle their holy nation. As a client state, the term was first used by anthropologist Mark Leone, they had to put their high places, their cities, and their deserts under the political and economic jurisdiction of the United States. Now that means that had to change, but how could they hold on to their purity? That's the real question. They had to give up being a holy nation. That was the cost of statehood. They had to give up their peculiar practice of plural marriage. That was the cost of statehood. They could not become a state of the Union unless they gave those up. There's no doubt about that. And Henry Wolfinger's back here. He knows that better than anybody else. They had to give it up. How could they hold on to their peculiarity? Now, this has not been written about very much, but I am going to suggest that virtually overnight, this domain that had been seen as foreign and menacing was domesticated. A little aside about the Sojourner in the Promised Land has a lot of stuff in an article called From Seder to Saint that shows that Americans started calling Mormons who were born in America foreign, because the practice of plural marriage seemed to them so alien to the United States that they could not believe that these people who were American citizens were not foreign. So if you look at what was written about the Mormons, which I did at great length, you find that foreign, again and again and again, these are foreigners. They're foreigners. Now, it is true that people were coming from England, but they were talking about the people that were born in New England as foreign. It's very interesting. Americans simply couldn't come to grips with it. And I suspect that Mormons today, if it became the law of the land that we could have plural marriage, I suspect that the people that would run the fastest from it are members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But this had kept them peculiar. Now, what happened when they had to give that up? Virtually overnight, this domain that had been seen as foreign and menacing was domesticated. Mainstream Protestants and a few by no means disinterested politicians kept up a warning drumbeat that the all-powerful Mormon Church still threatened American freedoms and that polygamy, which they said was still rampant, continued to place the American family in peril. Now, what it would did to the American family out there to have a few people, and not a few, there were a lot of them practicing plural marriage out there, but what it did to the American family and the rest of the nation is really as hard for me to understand as it is hard for me to understand now why gays and lesbians who are apart from everybody else are threatening the American family. I just can't understand it. But that's the way Americans seem to think, that if everybody doesn't do like they do, then it's a threat. Anyway, that's a little side of it too. Well, let me stay with my text now, and I'll force myself to stay with my text. But here's what happened. Everybody was saying that the Mormons were still a threat, but Transcontinental Railroad travel was initiating such a tourist boom that despite these dire warnings, a rapid metamorphosis turned what had once been decried as a dangerous domain into a place picture postcards and pictorial guidebooks called Mormon Land. There are a number of guidebooks who are called Mormon Land. In this new situation, the LDS kingdom became a culture and not simply a form of religion. As it did so, a new Mormon peculiarity emerged, one that had definite ethnic dimensions. This development became obvious when prefiguring what it really was. So, increasing numbers of Latter-day Saints lived elsewhere, but those people who lived elsewhere, even if they had never been there, started thinking about the Great Basin as home. There's a very nice little book now about Mormonism in Indiana, and the author talks about the fact that many of these Latter-day Saints had never been to Utah. They were not numerous enough to have wards, so they worshiped in Protestant churches, but they understood themselves as Latter-day Saints because they took care of the missionaries and they talked with the missionaries about what was going on at, quote, home. Latter-day Saints, no matter where they lived, started thinking of the Great Basin as home. That's really interesting because it connects Mormons with Mormon land. Now, the situation has become so different in the church that connection, I think, the church is trying to break. Inside the saintly circle, the Mormons continued to think of themselves as a peculiar people. Outside the circle, they started to seem more like an ethnic group than a church that might challenge traditional Christianity, and so people were no longer afraid of them. Rather than appearing threatening to the American family as they had in the 19th century, the saints started being admired for their exemplary family life as well as for their sincerity and for the way they took care of their own. And almost overnight, Mormons who had been seen as dangerous became Mormons who were super American, giving us an example of what family life ought to be like. By the middle of the 20th century, it was not just the saints' relationship with the outside world that was changing. Mormons' internal scenario was also dramatically altered as membership in the LDS Church increased almost exponentially. Because the great majority of Mormon converts remained in their own homelands, rather than being overwhelmingly concentrated in the Great Basin, Latter-day Saints were quite suddenly everywhere. And not just in the United States. Mormon stakes and wards, once mainly located in Mormon land, were organized all across the globe. Some may argue that I am going too far when I suggest that the situation faced by the LDS Church and its members at the opening of the 20th century differs as much from the situation they knew before World War II as the situation Mormonism had to face after the church abandoned the practice of plural marriage and dismantled the kingdom. But it seems obvious to me that in moving to curtail use of the Mormon label, the church is moving away from a past in which being a peculiar people meant being a part of an ethnic group whose homeland is located in the Intermountain West. Other than being a temple-going people, exactly what the new structure of Latter-day Saint peculiarity will be is not entirely clear. But the history of the way the signals of elders' peculiarity have been modified as situations have changed indicates that this particular Church of Jesus Christ and its members will find ways to keep themselves set apart well into the latter days. And I believe that that will happen. But I believe that the church is separating by trying to get rid of being called the Mormon Church and really down deep saying we don't want to be called Mormons is trying to say we are church members. It's moving away from people, which you got not because you had a conversion experience, but because you were born to Mormon parents. In 1960, when I first met the Mormons, being born Mormon was analogous to being born Jewish. In the year 2000, being born Mormon is more like being born a Protestant who has to be converted in order to become a church member. So you begin to hear again and again and again, and the brethren have written about this in the incident and so forth. I mean, even if you were born to Mormon parents, and that they actually, 10 years ago, they were still saying born to Mormon parents, it was necessary for you to have a conversion experience to become a true Latter-day Saint. Church membership is a lot different from peoplehood, because church membership then can be granted, and it can be taken away. This is the key. Church membership is something that depends on activity, depends on having a testimony that is appropriate to what the church at that point actually says a testimony ought to be. Whereas peoplehood meant you were born Mormon. In my own experience, and I only have a couple more pages, so I'll stop and say this. In my own experience, back in the days when being Mormon was a part of being a people, it was a common experience for me, once people knew that I knew a lot about the Latter-day Saints, to be at a university cocktail party, caught over in the corner by a Mormon, three sheets to the wind, without the whiskey in his hand, explaining to me why the church had gone wrong. But never heard to him that he might not be connected to the church anymore. It was the church was going wrong. He was, or she was, a Latter-day Saint. DNC is disappearing. Well, okay. Why now? Aside from what is being represented by this move, that is reclaiming the exclusive claim, reclaiming the notion that they are the Church of Jesus Christ, or you guys are the Church of Jesus Christ, there is an interesting question of why this move is being made just now. The changed terminology may not be a marketing move, but the church is currently led by a president who has spent most of his life in church public relations. He and his colleagues recognize an opportunity as golden as the angel Moroni standing on the spire of the Washington Temple, and they are seizing the day. They make no bones about taking advantage of the fact that people from all over the world will be pouring into Salt Lake City for the 2002 Winter Olympics next February, and that some 9,000 or 10,000 media representatives will be among the arriving visitors. These media people will be reporting on the games, to be sure. But they are also likely to tour Temple Square, where they will be greeted by a huge and impressive corps of appealing representatives of the church. They will see the magnificent Mormon temple and tour the Mormon tabernacle, and perhaps hear the famed tabernacle choir. They may visit the extraordinary new conference center, which Mary Bradford calls the Meganacle, which seats 21,000 church members at each semi-annual conference session. They will tour the Joseph Smith building, named for the church's Mormon prophet, and the 28-story church office building. Additionally, featuring exhibits of Latter-day Saints from all over the world, the LDS Museum of History and Art will be open, as will the Family History Center, which houses the largest collection of genealogical records ever amassed in the history of the world. Because so many saints have served overseas as missionaries and mastered languages other than English, the Latter-day Saint guides will be able to share the story of the Latter-day Saints with visitors in their native tongues. Of course, they will be schooled in using the approved nomenclature. I mean, they'll probably get kicked off of Temple Square if they call themselves Mormons. Therefore, the new terminology will seem to these people who have never been to Salt Lake City before the correct terminology. This is a smart move. Nobody ever said the brethren were dumb. They are not. It's a very smart move. Therefore, the new terminology will seem standard, and if it is used in even half the stories about all this that will be filed and broadcast and printed all over the world, it will jumpstart change. Then, in a process not unlike the change in language that's occurred in the areas of race and gender in American culture in recent years, the altered terminology will become the norm, and the word Mormon will be separated from Mormon land. Well, maybe. But visitors to the Olympics are bound to discover that Salt Lake City is not merely the church, capital, writ large. They will discover that when Apostle Dallin Oaks said that he did not being called a Mormon, but he did not want it to be said that he's a member of the Mormon Church, he was making an important distinction between the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the people called Mormons. Many residents of Salt Lake City are both, but church membership designates activity these days in the institutional life of the faith, while Mormon not only refers to average church members, but also to cradle saints, people who were born in the covenant to Mormon parents, but who are not active in the church. Actively involved or not, such saints understand themselves to be a part of the culture, but not the church. Consequently, despite the demographic reality that half of the people living within the city limits are not Latter-day Saints, this cultural overlay is a fact of Salt Lake City life. As a result, virtually everyone in the city has a religious identity. They are either Mormons or they are not Mormons. Just divide up the world. 50 Latter-day Saints kept reminding themselves they were the gathering of Israel by calling everyone else outside the church Gentile. Across the past half century, however, church authorities have discouraged the use of this designation. First, church members were told that people outside the church should be described as non-Mormons. This designation was subsequently changed to non-members and more recently to non-LDS. This last change may change quickly, since the church does not want to be known as the LDS church, but I will tell you, a member of the public affairs staff told me that non-LDS was better than non-member. You know, so anyway, by and large, the saints have complied with these instructions, but the non-Mormon population has not been as cooperative. Many, perhaps most, of the non-Mormons in Salt Lake City continue to call themselves Gentiles. It's really interesting. And they go out of their way to emphasize their distance from the saints, sometimes in the most amazing ways. For example, just off the boundary of the campus of the University of Utah, which sometimes seems to pride itself on being a Gentile bastion in Mormon land, a roadside sign announces the next 2 miles of this highway are maintained by members of the pagan community. It is probable that the claim of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to the new shortened name form is not likely to be of great concern to the people who put up that sign, nor to a substantial proportion of the non-Mormon population whose religious identity is more negation of Mormonism than it is a positive commitment to another faith. But in Salt Lake City and its suburbs, there are also large numbers of conservative Protestants, Roman Catholics, and members of Orthodox communities. A goodly proportion of these people may reject the church's new shortened name as the Church of Jesus Christ out of hand. And in fact, there have already been letters to the editor in the Salt Lake City newspapers. Ordinarily, the division in this city between those who are Mormon and those who are not is fairly subtle. But the spotlight being trained on the city as a result of the approaching Olympic Games seems to be emphasizing the existence of those divisions. The reactions of other faith communities to this new name change could make the divisions much more evident. Everyone knows that Mormon dissidents and the self-proclaimed Gentiles in the community are likely to make their presence known through organized protests during the Olympic Games. It's big brouhaha about where that can be done. It seems to me, however, that long before the torch reaches the valley, it is not at all unlikely that a protracted struggle over whose church really is the Church of Jesus Christ could end up adding an unanticipated sort of competition to it, to the venue for the 2002 Olympic Games. Before I start taking questions, I want to say this. There is another part of this evening, so I'm going to take questions for about 10 minutes. If my watch is right, that would get us up to 9 o'clock. And then we will have a little break, and then we'll come back for the rest. Is that okay, Janelle? Okay. All right. A question, hand right up here. Now stand up and say your question aloud because they're taking it. They're trying to get it on tape.
What is the likely means then for the church formerly known as the Mormon Church to use as a fence-in, fence-out method? Polygamy's gone. Everybody's adopted the word of wisdom. What's left?
What's left? One of the things that is left, and probably the most important thing that is left, is the temple. I have a very interesting new phrase, not said to me, but by a friend of mine, who said the templization of Mormonism, the effort to make a distinction between those Latter-day Saints who are temple-going Mormons and those that are not, may very well get bigger and bigger and bigger. And certainly the temple is going to be, according to the news, when they did that big story about the Mormons and the Olympics in USA Today. We had a bit. It was at a meeting that was with a bunch of people from the media, and I had a bet that they would that the reporter would ask me about plural marriage. He did not. What did he ask me about? He asked me about the temple. And more and more and more and more, when I talked to members of the media, this is the question they want me to answer. So much so that I wrote a little piece for them to read because they were so confused about it, and it's in my new book. So you can read what I wrote for the media. Question here and be sure to get it.
Sure. I know you're a historian and not a lawyer, but the trademark element seems clear in this issue. And I'm wondering what trademark law, to the extent you looked at the century, was or was not about who could get a name and use it. And I guess now, I don't know if they went and looked to see if you can have a trademark on a church name like the Church of Jesus Christ. What do you think about the use of a name as a trademark and its role in a kind of a legal context to distinguish you against someone else?
Well, I guess I would have to put it here. I guess, first of all, I would find it a little bit difficult to have the United Methodist Church with the thing underneath it says trademark. You know, it looks perfect. I think it would be really tough to make the case that you own the name, the Church of Jesus Christ, because there is a handbook of American denominations and there are at least 9 groups who already had this name before the Brethren made this statement. And I went back because of the, you know, a good portion of my life is turns out to be helping reporters to understand. And so I said, well, I just happen to have the handbook of Christian churches. So I looked up the Church of Jesus Christ. There are 9 of them already. So I think the church is going to have a tough. It's going to be a tough sell. And then there are a lot of them that are very close to that. Yes?
In France, Belgium, and Austria, there's pending legislation about cultism and Mormonism. Do you think this has any effect on the name change?
It might. I have to say, though, that is by no means new. There, in the early part of the 20th century, all over Europe, there were all kinds of people who were trying to make a distinction, and the United States government went along by saying that if you were a member of the Mormon Church, and that's the way the legislation was written, you could not immigrate to the United States. And Senator Reed Smoot got rid of that. So I don't know that, but I do think that the internationalization of the church has everything to do with it. Everything to do with it. First of all, LDS translates in some really weird ways in some places. And Latter-day Saints didn't always translate. And they need to say we are a Mormon church, a Christian church. And they, you know, Orthodox churches and Catholic churches and Protestant churches are not all alike. So it's not up to them to say, our understanding of atonement is very different from everybody else's. Yes, Mel.
I just wanted to comment on the globalization, internationalization, and corporatization, and to think about templization as part of a franchising strategy. But you may have other comments on that.
Oh, well, the thing where I first wrote about the franchising strategy was in the thing that I wrote in the Atlas of Mormonism, where I talked about the use of the building of the standard meeting house and the way, of course, I stole it from Marty Bradley, who wrote this wonderful master's thesis called The Church and Colonel Sanders. but that notion of, see, I think that's part of what's going on right now. I think, and this is tied to correlation, I think that the brethren, seeing the danger of many Mormonisms with an S, decided that Mormonism would be the same wherever you met it. And that involves a kind of standardization that is not unlike what they do when they create what we used to call a hamburger, but now it's just known as a McDonald's. Yes, Frank.
Jan, I'm just intrigued by what you have to say about the identification of Mormons as foreigners by certain nativist groups in the 19th century. And when the Republican Party had its first national platform, and the Republican Party included the many know-nothings.
Yeah.
And the platform called for the ridding of America of the two relics of barbarism.
The twin relics of barbarism.
Polygamy and slavery. And there are sort of these bumps of nativist activity, 1850s, 1880s, 1920s. Is it the same players who are going after the Catholics and the Mormons, by and large?
Yes, in fact, especially in the 80s, especially in the second half of the 19th century. I was working on the piece that's called From Seder to Saint, in my new book. Yeah, I keep pushing my new book there. You guys all know it. But I was working on that and was in the department with the man who wrote a big book on the American Protective Association, which it was an association to protect the nation from Catholics. And I started coming up with all of these stories or these headlines and these stories that I was showing to him, and he'd say, I can show you the very same headline, it just doesn't say Mormon, it says Catholic. And in fact, in the beginning, it was Mormons and Jews. And then it was Mormons and Catholics. Now it's Mormons and cultists. So really, you know, anybody that,
perhaps it didn't, or wasn't intended to be somewhat, put a sinister spin on templization, but I'm a little uncomfortable with us taking that in a negative connotation.
I don't mean to at all.
I'm not saying you were, but if it's an important, if the ordinances of the temple are important, they need to be somewhere other than Salt Lake, because not everybody can go there. And so, you know, we're not thinking franchising and so forth as necessarily being
something no.
we don't want.
No, oh no, no, no. And in fact, I didn't mean to say it, and I'm sorry.
No,
but
no,
but see, critically in this templization of Mormonism is the building of the small temples everywhere, so that there are so many new temples now. It is, in fact, to take it away from just Salt Lake. I mean, it was a very big deal to build a high-profile temple here. But to build these small temples is a bigger deal. Very much bigger. Because it makes the temple ceremonies available to all. And it is, you know, it is, I should say, one of the things about my studying the Mormons. Somebody was asking me about this. I was once on Top of the Nation with Ray Suarez, and he was, Elder Ballard was on there as well, and Elder Ballard tends to talk a lot, maybe not as much as I do, but he tends to talk a lot. And one of the cults said, this ought not to be a Mormon infomercial. And so Ray Suarez turned to me, and he was trying to find something that I could criticize the church for. And he said, now, why aren't you angry that the church of, you know, the Mormon church will not allow you to go into the temples and see and observe the temple's ceremonies? Couldn't you be a better historian if you could see them? And my answer was no, to his disappointment. I said, you can go into temples before they are dedicated. And I flew to Denver to go into the temple before it was dedicated because I felt it was necessary for me to do. Now, you know, my good friend Richard Bushman once said to me, there's a very easy way. But in fact, it seems to me respect for what is sacred makes me a better observer of Mormonism than if I insisted on seeing. Because then you know what the saints value. Yeah. So, yes.
Don't you think that a templization of the church, so to speak, would make us more cultish instead of less?
Well, I think that remains.
For cultism?
Oh, excuse me, I went ahead to answer your question before you finished. But I think that remains to be seen. I think all these reporters that are calling to me and saying, why can't we go in? Why can't we see? And I do see that the brethren are, with correlation, making changes. I went up to see the Boston Temple before it was dedicated. And that was the first time they had people who, in taking you through, told you. I mean, you had to hurry, and if you didn't sort of know the language, you might lose a lot of it. But they at least were trying to explain what was going on. I think they're making a big effort to explain. And you look at what it says about the ordinances in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, and everything is there except the words. You know, it just, there's an awful lot there.
But if you want to retreat from cultism, you don't want to have more secret.
Except, no, it is, that's different. Because it is saying to new members, as well as current members, there's something very special about being a part of this church. It's the way Catholicism used to have keep hidden behind the altar what went on in preparing the elements for the Eucharist. There's something about maintaining mystery. Now, people may misunderstand it, but I think the church has to weigh. Now, they don't ask me what they ought to be doing, but I think they're doing, I think they have to weigh exactly your worry that this makes it seem cultish with a providing for the Latter-day Saints an understanding that as Latter-day Saints we have this right to be a part of these ordinances. I don't know what, but nevertheless it certainly is the most It is the clearest indication of peculiarity that is visible. And see, peculiarity always is valuable. And you just have to weigh those things. Yes. And I'll take this and one more.
Just one comment on the temporalization. I think there's another risk that might weaken the church to some degree, and that is I have been active to a degree in this area for 20 years and have witnessed this temporalization. And I'm not an observant Mormon or one who goes to the temple, but I always felt comfortable going to church and participating on certain activities. And I feel increasingly estranged and like a second-class citizen, because if you don't have a temple record, as my wife said, I think they're getting to where you're going to need a temple record for the sacrament. And if you do feel second class and disenfranchised, and I believe people like us, especially in Salt Lake, there's a lot of us who value our Mormonism and are nourished to a certain degree, but are increasingly felt like, well, we're not worthy, so we're next.
Well, you know, I know that's happening, and I know it's happening. It's happening to people in Bloomington as well, to my Latter-day Saint friends all over. And at every level, I have a lot of friends that are, you know, that wouldn't know a sunstone if they saw one. But nevertheless, they're beginning to feel that too, this kind of thing. However, 10 years ago, when I wrote an article for a book called Contemporary Mormonism, Social Science Perspective, I was just beginning to see this distinction between peoplehood and church membership. And what I worried about, and what's in that article, because I always embed in the articles my worries, to sort of say to the church, here's what's going on. What I began to worry about is, if you were a convert, you would become second class, because it would be, if you were born under the covenant, you were somehow special. And if you converted, you became second class. Now, what this has done is, by moving away from that and moving toward the temporalization, at least it says to you, if you decide you don't want to be second class, you can do something about it yourself. As long as it's birthright, there's nothing you can do. So that's the thing. Okay, this is the last one.
I found it interesting your comment that polygamy, the argument was that it would destroy the marriages in America. That is the very argument the Mormon Church uses for trying to defeat gay marriages, saying that if gay marriages are allowed, it will destroy marriages in America. As a historian, what is your perspective on this?
I wonder if the brethren would be surprised, I expect not, to know that sometimes the very same arguments that were used against plural marriage are, that the church is now using against gay marriage, are the same. I mean, word for word, the same kind of the argument. But of course, remember that the church currently is using the same language to put down the fundamentalists. So they are saying what people used to say about Latter-day Saints in the 19th century, they are saying about plural marriage now. Yeah, so... Okay.